Okay, we're just bouncing right now for a moment the difference between Mishpatim and Kisetze. This is Man and Society. Today's February 24th. That Torah wants to do between the pitfalls that may accrue to a society that's totally capitalistic and a leveling of the playing field, which is inherent to a socialistic type of society, is that we appreciate lo tachmod, don't covet what someone else has, and if you want it, so just work harder, you know, try to be more industrious. And but the Torah wants to create a sense of vatranut, is that I'm so open with my money, I won't charge interest, I'll let the strands fall down and leave it on the floor for the poor called leket, I'll let the bundles fall to the floor called shikha, I'll leave a standing grain in the corner of my field for standing grain, 1/60th of it, that's called peah, and then especially other tithes and charities. And if I create such a framework, so the evils that may accrue to a capitalistic society, hopefully I'll be able to avoid. Right? The competition of Cain and Hevel that moves through those first inventors at the end of Perek Dalet led to the flood, led to the Hamas and the Gezel and the evils that caused God to destroy the world. Right? So man looked at all that, and what does man do right after leaving the flood? Come on, what's the next major story in the Torah? Dora Flugger. Do you see how that bounces off to the other extremes?
Exactly.
Everyone is one language, one speech, they're all talking the same. That is North Korea, and Hashem doesn't like it. It's Shali Shachar Shachar Shali. Hashem confounds them. There's nothing wrong with everyone speaking the same language, as long as it's not coerced. I think there's still something wrong with that. I think everyone's exactly the same. No greater tyranny than forcing everybody into the equality. That's what led to, after America left the Southeast Asia, in Cambodia, they killed people for wearing glasses. Right? Why do we get a heads up on these guys? Well, because they don't need glasses? How do you know? Maybe he needs glasses, he just can't afford them. So how dare you show that you're ahead and you're on a higher level than he is? People would get killed for that. Right? Wearing glasses was a capital crime in Cambodia. Right? So that's what you get because you can't show that you're ahead of him. So and it was inherent in the you see in the writings of Trotsky and the writings of Lenin that they of course we're gonna have to kill tens of thousands of people, maybe even hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions. I congratulate the Beatles for at least writing a line in one of their songs. If you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't going to make it with anyone anyhow. Right? They wrote that at a time where these real useful idiots were congratulating themselves over what was going on in China and North Korea. I mean, really crazy stuff. Why? Because, everyone's equal there. And no religion, too. John Lennon would sing some years later. Yeah, I guess he changed his mind. Actually, I know he did. I know he did because if you're familiar with some Beatles music, the Beatles sang that same song. It's called Revolution on a later album, Slowly. You know what I'm talking about? It's called Revolution Number One. And early on, the song says, "If you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?" That's the original song, the one that goes fast on Hey Jude. But the one that appeared later on the White Album is Don't You Know That You Can Count Me Out? And then he says, listen carefully to the song. He became radicalized, which led to the imminent breakup of the Beatles. Don't you know that you can count me out? Destruction. Really? Really, John Lennon? Destruction? You mean you want to put forth those ideals of imagine because you maybe actually read some of Trotsky and Lenin, right? And you paid attention to what Mao and Stalin did? That the only way to get this forced equality is to destroy? Chazal are right on top of this when they say that Migdal Babel, they threw human beings into the mortar to make the bricks. Right? Could you read some of the testimony from the people who from North Korea that they collected at the UN? What happens to people if they made a simple, small mistake in the factory? They cut off a finger. It's just crazy. That's what happened in Migdal Bavel. Migdal Bavel is North Korea. And then after all that, it's all about the people, the masses. That's what ancient codes want. They want equality and a fine working machine that works under the king. No one does charity. Only the king. You have to be beholden to the state. Right? That's big government, isn't it? Right? I don't want charity, says Hammurabi in his introduction to the code, the most famous code of the ancient world. I don't want individual charity. You give me your taxes, I do the charity, they're beholden to me, to the state. You get your house from the state, you get your job from the state. Right? That's not what the Torah is. The Torah tries to perfect the individual, and through the individual perfection, we will come to that orderly society that you want. Okay? Alright, we left last class with the portion of seduction. What is left for us in the casuistic section is witchcraft, bestiality, and idolatry. What kind of triad is this? Witchcraft, bestiality, and idolatry. What is the Torah doing here? First, turn to the Pasuk Tesvav. Right? See, another interesting thing that Shalom Paul points out, and this is very big in Kaufman's Toldot Emunat Yisrael, is that the Torah is again unique in its very harsh treatment of witchcraft and magic. With me, it's definitely Kuf Nun Gimel. Kuf Nun Dalet. Mechashefa lo techaya. Short little pasuk. Why does it say it this way? I mean, don't let a witch live. It should say, kill a witch. Right? What do you mean, don't let a witch live?
Where are we, Rav?
Pasuk Yud Zayin. Page 308, it's hard to me. You see, we've been reading all these tukim this way, with this logic, is that there could be a fear of going after a witch. Why? Because maybe she'll curse you. Right? The Torah wants to say they don't have the power to curse. That power is in your head, not in hers. Right? I digress to Bilam. Why was Bilam so successful? He had no power. People gave him the power. Bilam was a great, great actuary. This is what Bilam was. And look, Bilam is called Bilam HaKosein. I'm telling you this from the standpoint of the Rambam. Right? I'll take Rashi afterwards. From the Rambam's standpoint, this is what Bilam was. And I actually have said to someone in my shul who gets paid tons of money to make predictions. He is not a Navi. He's just very good at taking your information and telling you what is the best investment to make. I mean, people call these guys life coaches, but that's not what he is. He works at Harvard, and he is one of the preeminent predictors of going from data to what should the company do now? Should you invest in this type of thing or in that type of thing? Or are we going to be moving towards investing in copper or gold or bronze or... And he just takes the world situation around what's going on, and he's able to put everything in. Okay, SARS is coming back to Saudi Arabia. This is what's going on in China. That's going on in Alberta and in Nova Scotia. This is what you need to do. Is he a Navi? No, he's just very good at putting all the data together. It's fascinating is that it's very phonetically close to the name Bilam, but there was an occupation in the ancient world. Every bit as important in armies as a good general and excellent weapons and good foot soldiers is your barum, Barum, that's what he was called. He was your cursor. You took your Barum to the top of a mountain, like Moshe with hands up, and he had feathers, or he had you know, smoke, and he had fires, and he would be doing this at the top of the mountain against the other side, and they'd get psyched out if he was good, if he had a good reputation. Right? Because they were so superstitious in the ancient world that sometimes just having Bilam on your side, because he was so good, he was a whore. Why do I call him that? Guys, tell me you're thinking.
Better
pay me. Yeah, he gave himself to the highest payer. Listen, I'm expensive, right? Because I do my homework. Whenever two people are fighting a war, he was so good at what he did, he was able to assess the situation. He had maybe 50 people working for him. I want you to spy. I want you to go and see how many men are on that side. How many men are on that side? I want you to see what kinds of weapons they have. I want you to see what they're doing. And this is how Bilam HaKosem, he was so good at it that he looked like a magician. You see some magic shows that these guys have black magic? No, they're just very good at sleight of eyes. Right? And some of the best ones even explain what they were doing afterwards. So I'm giving rationale to what Bilam did. And the Torah calls him a Kosem. What about the woman who calls back Shmuel at the end of Sefer Shmuel, right? You know what I'm talking about? Right? The necromancer, you all know what I'm talking about here? Right? Shaul didn't know what's going to happen, and he couldn't make it. The Urim didn't answer, the Nevi'im didn't answer. The Urim, he killed all the Kohanim, Shmuel was dead. He was not in a... You know, most Sephardic commentaries say it was all fake. There was either a man under the table. Of course, you have to deal with how that man under the table got everything right. He predicted exactly everything. So that's a problem, I'll agree. So the other benefits of the commentaries who ask that question say, it wasn't the witch who called back. Shmuel was called back and said exactly what was going to happen.
God did it.
It was God who did it. That's why she started screaming when she saw Shmuel. She said, whoa, this never happened before. Every other time was a fake guy under the table. And she gave him a drink that got him, you know, just hallucinating to think whatever he wanted, you know. And then we're going to think, Shmuel, you know, with the lights and the black and the surroundings. They would believe anything at that point, right? So if you say it was Hashem doing it, you solve your problem of how you get it so right. Who would have the chutzpah to say you're going to die tomorrow with your sons and everything's right? Who would have the chutzpah to say that? What if it doesn't happen? Right? The Rambam has a fascinating paper. She says, you know, it wasn't God and it wasn't the woman. It was Shaul himself. She hypnotized him. And you know, under hypnosis, there are some amazing things that can be done. If she was aware of how to do that, she hypnotized him and he became Shmuel.
Wow.
It's an amazing parish. Well, look at there, Rabbah, Perchav Chesim, Shmuel Aleph. Anyway, so that too can be explained rationally. A human being does not have the power of witchcraft. So why does the Torah say not to kill them? To kill them? Because people think they have powers. That's why the Torah says Mechasheva lo sechayeh. Why does it say Mechasheva? Because most of the people doing it at that time were women. With me? Right. Alright, now the Talmud does tell stories about witches and Shimon ben Shetach and how he got them to he found their hiding place in Yerushalmi and Sanhedrin. He found the hiding place of all those witches, and what he did was he took 80 men in a blinding rainstorm with clothes that were wrapped up in bags. And just as they got to the inside the cave where they were hiding, he told them to strip from your wet clothes and put on these dry clothes and go in and say, we are witches also. See, we came in the rain and our clothes are all dry. Right? So they all made it in there and they said, so show us what you do. And he goes, no man has ever seen what we do. He goes, look, we're witches too. What are you afraid of? Right? They convinced them they're witches by coming in with the dry clothes and the blinding rainstorm outside. I'd be making here with all these clothes, right? So they showed their arts, and Shimon ben Shetach had all 80 of them killed. The Bavli just says he had 80 witches killed. It doesn't tell how he had it done, but that's what he did. And the witches in turn got someone to give false testimony to kill, to have Shimon ben Shetach's son killed by the courts, by the Sanhedrin. And he said to his son, "Did you really do that?" He goes, "No, Dad. You know I didn't do that." And he said, and actually, but it was a Gemar Din. The Sanhedrin heard the evidence. And Shimon Shetach did not make an appeal, because if you have a Gemar Din, you have to do it. His son is killed. Anyway, it's a very different story told in the Bavli, but the point is, don't get me started here, in the tangent, my head just flies. But the point is that in the shot of the Talmud Bavli and the Yerushalmi, it seems that there is that magic. People have that power. And Rambam explains it all the way. The rationalists say, no human being has that power. The only reason why the Torah is so harsh with them is because people think they have the power and it drives them away from Torah. Okay. Comes that even the Egyptians were all sleight of hand. Rashi and the Imei, the Ramban and others say, no, this power exists. It's out there. And that's certainly why the Torah has to come down so hard on it. Because if you have that power and use it in an unholy way, Rashi says that, remember, where did it spread? It was the Shem Tumah that Avraham gave to Yishmael and the other sons. Everything else he gave to Yitzchak. You familiar with this, Rashi? Parshas Chayisar? Gave Shem Tumah. I once heard an explanation from Chaim Sober about the Chinese arts. The Chinese, the meaty, the meridian, the way you touch certain parts of the body, acupuncture, other things like that, it comes from this thing. The meridian is the way that, they see they have the Chinese arts, they have nothing to do with, they don't have Torah. It goes around the head, around the back, down like this, and one reaches the navel, the other down to the penis, and one goes down around the arm, 7 rabbins around the arm, out the middle finger, and that's it. And you know that the Gemara says that the tefillin should be 2 wrappings, one a little longer than the other, one going down to the gid, one going down to the navel. They're not supposed to be the same size, the 2 of them coming down. It's supposed to be one a little longer. Usually it's the same size, though. But in Chinese arts, for them it's tumah, but for us, we channel that so that, according to Rashi, according to this idea, these are there's a lot of chokhmah in God's world that we can tap into. We have to tap into it through tefillin, through kedusha. Don't look for any shem tumah.
Where are the laws of tefillin written?
What?
Where are the specific laws of tefillin written?
I mean, it's Gemara's. I mean, it's the Menachos. All right. So this is why it says lo sechayeh. Okay. Don't let them live. You have to, by implication, we understand what that means. Okay. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that in order to be mechashev, there has to be zeh ha'oseh ma'aseh, v'lo zeh ha'ocheizes ha'inayim. Okay? Not ocheizes ha'inayim, it means like a magic show. So how do you know what's magic and what's witchcraft? Let the magician show you what the post can discuss this, whether you're allowed to attend a really good magic show. Only if they show you how they did it. Or only if you shouldn't leave thinking that it's no, that's just magic. Right? Okay, so that's that. Kol shochevin behemah mos yumas. That's yudches. You sleep with an animal. Mos yumas. What's going on with that?
Sounds pretty
self-explanatory. Right. So, it's only in masculine. We learned from other psukim, says the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin, that it's true for a woman also. It's true whether it's the man or the woman is passive or active, whatever it is. Any sexual connection between an animal and a human being, anyway, is punishable with death. Why such a harsh punishment like this? We learn elsewhere in the Torah that that's not only true of the animal, of the human, it's true of the animal too. Right? Even though the animal is a sort of an innocent bystander, so to say. Right? That's the halacha. Right? The question is, how does this fit in? How does this all fit in with in this place? In this setting?
These laws are trying to create a fortified and upholding upstanding society. And I feel like if you have people sleeping with animals, it kind of just breaks down society.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Remember, I spoke about animals before, cruelty and kindness to animals, right?
Yeah.
Do you know, you'll shiver and shake when you hear what I'm about to tell you. The society in the history of mankind that had had the most far-reaching animal rights laws.
Nazi Germany.
Can you hear that again? You know you can go to jail for beating a German shepherd in Nazi Germany, 1944, 43. This, when they're murdering 1.5 million children, throwing them right into burning fires. But you can go to jail for hitting a German shepherd.
That's literally a blessing, huh?
When my father was, the ghetto was liquidated, emergency posters were placed all over the ghetto, and I'm sure in others. He just was only familiar with this one. I don't remember reading it about others, but they put up emergency posters. An important meeting in the center of some town square or something, town hall. What are we going to do with all the pets the Jews are leaving behind? Just have some cats, some dogs, some goats. You know. Paul's just is aided and assisted and abetted the systematic murder in the streets and whatever it was, was carted off. No, they knew everyone by that time knew where they were going. My father was fortunate enough to escape with a few people hiding under the bridge and under the water with like straws. They found reeds and they breathed through using like snorkels. Luckily, it was early September. It was still warm enough to do that. Everyone passed over the bridge. They made their way back into town. They spent the rest of the war flying on flight. So my father spent once one full year not talking to another human being. Younger than you guys. Imagine such an existence. And he was lucky. Never, he was never caught. He made it to the end of the war. Like that. His ghetto was liquidated in the end of 42, and he was way northeastern Poland, so the Russians came in and liberated in early 44, so you know, he was lucky, I guess, yeah. Anyway, imagine such a thing. You are just killing tens of thousands of people from a large city, I'm imagining some people actually, it's comical almost. I mean, can you say, it's so, Can you just wrap your fingers around this? Zovchei Odom Agolim Yishokun. They slaughter humans and kiss their animals. Father remembers also. It's so crazy the daily life in the ghetto. If one of the commanders walks in the street and you don't take off your hat, he'll kill you. If he says good morning, and one day you answer good morning, Commandant, shoot him right away. Don't you dare address me directly. So the word gets out in the street. If he says good morning, don't answer. The next day he says good morning, and he walks by and he shoots him because how dare you not respond to me when I talk to you? So there was just the terror, the daily terror. So my father remembers there was one of the commandants. He trained a German shepherd on a certain whistle, and he pointed. The guy would jump on the back of an old man. My father remembers seeing this as a kid. They'd bite him all over the ear and blood spurt out, kill him on the spot. And then he'd come back, whistle again, he'd come back and kissed the guy right on the mouth. The dog came up to kiss him right on the mouth. Give him a kiss on the mouth. He did a good job. He gave him some food. Right? Be careful because, and I go back to what I heard from Dennis Prager this morning. If a human being is cruel to an animal, he can be cruel to a human being too. In fact, I forget which Rebbe. It was a Rebbe who said, someone who hits an animal will hit a human being too. That's probably correct. The Torah is very careful about nature and the environment and animals. There's a din, Tsar Bali Chaim is a Doraisa. It's more about Metziah. Right? At the same time, however, there is no correlation between kindness to animals and kindness to people. I end where I started. The society that has produced the far and away most draconian animal protection laws was Nazi Germany. Look what they were doing to human beings. So they had to train their populace, and Europe went right along. They were nurtured on this for 1800 years of Catholic treatment of the Jews. Don't tell me that there's nothing in Christianity that could produce the Holocaust. Everything within Christianity is what was used to produce the Holocaust. They also made us walk around with distinctive garb in 1200. They also made us wear distinctive hats and put us into ghettos and practice genocide on men, women, and children. Nazi Germany was different. They had technology. Anyway, the point I'm making is that the Torah wants to be very careful of your devolving into this kind of behavior. Yes?
Screwing with animals isn't necessarily kindness to animals, you know?
No, in some ways. No, there could be many other things working here.
Right.
But it is, it's just something that they want some sexual pleasure. Right? The Torah doesn't say don't sleep with a tree, right? A crack in the wall or something. But you know what I'm saying? It's just that it might also be, I'm not afraid to say this, that certain strands of diseases that you put with mixed with animals. Remember there was a movie about a bat that had a piece of a banana that fell from its mouth into a pigsty, and a sick pig ate it, and someone ate the pig and killed 3 to 4 billion people.
So,
and it killed like 3 or 4 billion people before they figured out what it was. So, the Torah is warning us, you mix people and monkeys and people and goats and people and you don't know what you are unleashing upon yourselves.
So there's a sort of Kalayim as well.
Yeah, that the Ramban actually writes in his Akdamah to Bereishis. He writes just that. You don't know what you are unleashing upon yourself. That's more in a mystical framework. Stay largely monogamous with the same woman, the same man, same family. What do you think killed off the Assyrians so quickly? They sent 20, 30, 40,000 women to the front lines, to the soldiers, to service them for months at a time, in long campaigns, in long sieges. It's probably what happened around Yerushalayim. Syrian records also describe that sometimes there's soldiers falling like flies by the tens of thousands. And the largest number they ever write is 135,000. In Tanakh, it's 180,000, but we quibble. When you have these women coming around to all and sleeping with all the men, a different one every night, everyone she ever slept with is that disease is being spread to this new man. And that's what the Torah says. You behave that way, the same thing that happened to them will happen to you. You follow my Torah, you stick to my program. I know things. I created you. I created this whole universe. All the microbes, everything as small as a microbe and as big as a black hole, I created them all. And I left this world for you to work with. Yeah, I can make this the best of all possible worlds by solving everything right away. Right, that's our topic in the Yeshayahu class. In Perakei. But that's not what I do, God says. God is a bread of shame. I'm not solving your problems. You work with them. You create a better world. Right? The last pasuk is, Zoveach lo Elohim Yocharam Bilti Lashem Levado. Now this Elohim, and I keep saying Elohim because I can write it on the board, it's not God's name. If it was God's name, it would be Zoveach. Can you pronounce it? How would it actually be pronounced if it was God? It would be Lelokim.
Without the Aleph.
Lelokim, without the Aleph pronounced. Lelokim. Lo Elohim means to a God. Zoveach Lelokim would be Zoveach to the God, which is the God that created heaven and earth that we pray to. This Elohim is Chol. Look at the Targum. Right? Didabach, which means to offer a korban. L'ta'avat amamaya. It's not Kodesh. Of course it's not. Look at the context. If you offer sacrifice to another god, Yocharam, you will be made cherim, you will be utterly destroyed. Don't offer anything except to God. Now, the Torah Tzmima quotes Gemaras that say that we actually learn some profound rules of Avodah Zarah from this pasuk. Here's the point. I'm going to make it quickly, but acquire it. In order to be guilty of worshipping Avodah Zarah, Avodah Zarah has to be particular to this particular Avodah Zarah. You with me? In other words, you have to know what's the way to worship this Avodah Zarah. Every Avodah Zarah is to worship differently. Right? If you would go to a shrine of Marduk and defecate on the altar, you wouldn't be chayav for doing that. But if you did that to Baal Peor, you would. Because that's the way to worship Baal Peor. You get my point? If you throw a rock at a mizbeach of Kamosh, all right. I hate that mizbeach. You throw a rock at. But if you throw a rock at Marculis, that's the way to serve Marculis. Okay. Some say Marculis is Mercury, the god of travel. Two stones like that. You throw a rock in between. You'll have a successful travel, successful journey. Right? So don't throw a rock at Marculis, even if you mean to show disrespect. Don't defecate in front of a Baal Peor, even if you mean to show disrespect. That's the ofen of the worship. That's what they do. Crazy, huh? The point of Baal Peor is to be as outrageously crazy as you can. As you said, anything goes in this religion. So good. And I knew how to get the young people to the temples. Right? So, but this establishes that if you make a zevach to any god, even if that's not the way to worship it, you're chayav. Get the point? Zevach is you slaughter an animal, even a grasshopper. Don't slit the throat of any animal to Avodah Zarah. Gemara discusses the grasshopper because it doesn't really have shoulders, so the animal has to have shoulder and a neck. But, all right, but anyway, you get what I'm saying. Don't slaughter a goat, don't slaughter a pig, don't slaughter any animal to any Avodah Zarah, because Zevach will be chayav, whether even if that god doesn't take Zevach. Then the Gemara extends this to pouring wine in front of them. Libations also. Bowing down and praying to them. Those are, however, based on other psukim in the Torah. If you bow to any Avodah Zarah, you are chayav, even if that Avodah Zarah says, you don't bow to me, I don't get bowed. You know what I'm saying? I don't get libations. Most do, by the way. Slaughter, zevach, libations, bowing, praying. Those are the four that's common to all Avodah Zarahs. And it's derived first from this pasuk. Now look, you see from the next pasuk, it's fair game also for a question. Look at the next pasuk. What happens? Look at pasuk base. Look at pasuk. I'm sorry, pasuk chaf. Look at it. What happens?
Take care of
it. Yeah, what's happening in that pasuk? No, come on. What does the Ger Lo Sonah stand like? Sound like? It's changed from everything we've been learning until now.
Slave
law. We had the slave law. Not by the nature of the law, but by the way it's written.
It's not
casuistic.
The Ger Lo Sonah doesn't want it's not here.
Say, if you have a Ger in your midst, make sure not to. No, it's just even that would sound that predictive. This is directly apodictic law. We have turned the corner. So, if you offer a zebach, don't offer it to an Avodah Zarah. Then it switches now to the Geulah. So notice a few things. The first apodictic law starts off the same way the parasha starts off, which is, a reminder. reminder of your very recent past. Okay? Next class, on Wednesday, Mitzvah Shem, I will give an overview of the apodictic section of Mishpatim. Okay? And then and maybe just a little description of what the test will be like, Mitzvah Shem, at the end of class. Okay?